want you to know that what you have just heard is Manny's theory to the Tullock-Downs corollary to Niskanen's extrapolation of von Mises's theorem to de Tocqueville's exposition to refute the Nader-Friedman law of regulatory agents.
That's the title of the article.
Subtitle is Follner's corollary to that, which is why I'm chairman. Because I just figured that out, because at the moment I'm the only federal employee here, and as chairman then I don't have to get up and say anything nasty about bureaucracy. Our second speaker today, or this evening, Dr. Madsen Peary, comes to us with a very distinguished academic record and also a distinguished political record. Two master's degrees from Edinburgh University, a PhD from the University of St. Andrews, former elected member of the Edinburgh County City Council, the only conservative to ever hold that particular seat, a registered campaign manager for Tory candidates, and currently associate professor of philosophy at Hillsdale. The capstone, however, to his political career, certainly, and the primary, or one of the reasons anyway, why he is on this panel this evening must have been his six-month tenure as a senior staff associate of the Republican Study Committee in the House of Representatives. Dr. Peary.
Well, I, of course, have the difficult job tonight, the number two speaker. One always runs the risk in being two out of three of being crucified between two thieves. So I took advice tonight and asked what precisely was the role I was being asked to fulfill. Well, I was told my main function was to give the audience a gentle letdown from the pinnacle of perspicacious perfection which preceded me to the song and dance act which will undoubtedly appropriate length of speech, and told that it didn't really matter as long as myself and the first speaker didn't exceed 20 minutes between us. I shall therefore not deliver the 1.5-hour lecture on English medieval poetry which I had prepared. I will instead make a few remarks on the subject. That very comprehensive and very flattering introduction was not complete. It failed to reveal one personal point about me, which I should confess now, so that my remarks about the problem in Britain will become more explicable. I am, I must confess, a Gnostic. More correctly, should I say, I am a Gnostic, since this is the term we always use in our secret meeting. We Gnostics took rather a bashing this afternoon, and I would like to say, in our defense, that we have grown considerably more subtle than the presentation of us might have led you to believe this afternoon. We're no longer trying to achieve utopia on Earth. We're simply trying to achieve the best possible society that human ingenuity and creativity can produce. Being Gnostics doesn't involve us in the belief that perfect society, or even the best society, can be achieved by any mystical understanding of human history, or even by the pursuit of a rational plan. No, no, we think it's basically all done by guesswork. We want a society in which as many people can guess on as many different issues as they like, and we can look at the results of the guesses and keep the ones whose results we approve of. Our high priest is Sir Karl Popper, the philosopher. We haven't told him yet, but we intend to fairly soon. Quick commercial, his works are available in America from Open Court Publishing Company. Which leads us very naturally to the problem of the visible hand. In Britain, which is what I'm supposed to talk about, and my excuse for talking about this, by the way, it is your own future. I came from Britain believing it was a very backward country, but I've since become convinced that it's very far ahead of yours, about 20 years, I'd say. To look at Britain now is like looking in the pages of a history book on the chapter ahead of the one you're living in. If any of you have any doubts what it's going to be like after you get your national health insurance and so on, I recommend the plane trip across the Atlantic. Just don't call it a letter. The visible hand in Britain has two very visible fingers raised in salute, which, if anyone is acquainted with British customs, will realize that is equivalent to one American finger raised in Those two very visible fingers are, of course, public housing and state-controlled industry. And I will not so much address myself as to what the problem is as to what the solution is, because there are still of us, those in Britain, mad enough to believe that the problem is capable of solution. That is, the agnostics. Public housing in Britain now accounts for something approaching one half of all housing in Britain. One half of all housing in Britain is not privately owned, but publicly owned, and people who live in it do so, for the most part, at subsidised rates. The rest of the community pays higher property taxes, these are called rates locally, and higher taxes in order that the other half of the community can live at below market cost in subsidised housing. This has many political advantages. If you belong to a political party on the left, you can say, vote for us and we'll keep your rents down, thereby guaranteeing the vote of almost everyone who lives in public housing, in order that you will be elected and can carve up the property and assets of the other half in order to keep down the level of rent. Several solutions have been tried. First of all, we tried raising the rents. This is no good. It doesn't work. When you try to raise the rents, you lose elections. That is because these public housing estates naturally form on average about half of every parliamentary district. And for some strange reason, they won't vote for people who say they're going to raise their rents. What usually happens is that Conservative governments get in and introduce rent acts, which are designed to make council house rents economic, or they issue directives to local governments that these subsidised rents are to be brought up to an economic level, and people, first of all, don't do it. They have rent strikes, and the trade unions, whose formidable power I'm sure was explained to you by Mr. Worsthal last night, object to it, and vast numbers of local councillors and members of parliament are elected who are opposed to this solution. Okay, so we tried that. The next thing we tried was really quite a brilliant stroke, that of offering them for sale. You see there, subsidised rents, why don't we sell them off to the people who live in them? And so, despite violent opposition, we were able to introduce a bill making it legal to sell them. No one wanted to buy. Not surprisingly, because they were living well below market cost. In case you don't realise what I mean by below market cost, let me explain that I mean an average of well below $40 a month. That is the British average. In Scotland 7 years ago, in one particular town near where I lived, the average was 25 cents per week, or $1 per month. I'm told it's since become more economic. It's now more like $2.50 a month in that particular town. You're dealing with a very serious problem. Well, if you can't raise the rents and you can't sell them, you might think that would leave the problem without any solution. No, no, the agnostics have come to the rescue, and a solution which has been quietly introduced to certain members of the Conservative Party is about to be made public in 1.5 months' time, when we intend to campaign very actively to get the Conservative Party to adopt it. I give this as a lesson, by the way. There is always hope, even with the most intractable problem. That solution is that we give them away. It is astoundingly simple. If you give them away, then you no longer have to charge high property taxes to the other people in order to provide subsidized rents. Of course, in giving them away, you wouldn't build any more. That is taken for granted. And in giving them away, you would make the individuals suddenly, at a stroke, owner-occupiers responsible for the maintenance of their own houses. It is, of course, grossly unfair. However, the present system is also grossly unfair, and at least this unfairness is over in a moment. Once you've given them away, the unfairness is ended. And it's even possible you might be able to give tax concessions spread over 10 years to the people who own their own houses to create the appearance of equity. There is one great advantage of this scheme, which I think easily is the most impressive, and that is, I explained earlier, these public housing estates provide about half the votes in every constituency. That great advantage is that it takes us, on average, 35 seconds to convert Conservative members of Parliament to this point of view. They see that when their opponent stands up and says, vote for me and I'll keep your rents down, they can now stand up alongside him and say, vote for me and I'll give you your house. Mechanistic and highly agnostic approach has the advantage of being politically realistic, that we can hope to convince a major party to endorse it in their own interest. Also, by the way, it has the advantage of being permanent, since I myself would not fancy the chances of any socialist candidate who stood up and said, vote for me and I'll take your house away from you. Leads us to believe that in that field, at least, there is hope. So one of the highly visible fingers of that visible hand, we think, is about to be amputated. The second of these highly visible fingers is, of course, the state-controlled industries in Britain, which now account for almost everything you can think of. I haven't been back to Britain for 4 months, so the list is probably twice as large as it was before I left. I'm told that shipbuilding has now been included, am I right? Yes. How many? Well, never mind. It already, before I went, included electricity, gas, what else? Steel, of course,
coal.
Railways, coal, etc., etc. You name it, and they've got it. of course, this has many advantages for politically in Britain, too. All you have to do is tax business so heavily that they don't make any profits and start losing money, whereupon the cry will come up from businessmen, oh, please nationalise our industry and take it over. And this has happened, of course, in Britain, and I'm sure will be happening in America in the near future. The problem here is that we can't denationalise them. The Conservative government in 1970 went to the polls on a determined platform of rolling back the state, that is, denationalising, and it achieved a working majority. Well, what did it denationalise? Did it take on the steel industry, the most recently acquired? No, it didn't. It didn't attempt to touch the coal mines or the railways or electricity or gas and so on. What it did manage to denationalise was the Carlisle breweries, which for some strange reason the state had acquired in 1917 because there was a munitions factory at Carlisle and they didn't like the thought of the workers becoming drunk while they were making shells for the British Army. That we denationalised. The other one we denationalised was a travel agency, which I believe was bought by a larger one, which has since gone broke. The basic problem is, of course, that it's all very well putting up for sale, but no one wants to buy. It makes a loss. It's made a loss every year for all, you know, all the disadvantages of state ownership. You know why it makes a loss, but the fact remains, it does make a loss. Now, what on earth do you do? Are we faced with the inevitable prospect of the number of industries the state controls increasing year by year? Well, no. Agnostics come to the rescue again. Basically, we ask a simple, almost epistemological question here. Who owns these industries? The answer is the state. Ah, yes, but what do you mean by the state? Why, we mean, of course, the public. Well, if the public owns them, then the public can have them. And so our approach here is to suggest that these industries, in fact, be given to the public, which allegedly owns them already. Now, the public, of course, owns them collectively at the moment. They own them through their wise and benevolent government. What we're proposing is that the public should own them individually. That is, that shares in these, I'll say companies, shares in these operations, these loss-making operations such as railways, coal mines, steel, etc., should be given out to the general public. You can then arrange all kinds of mechanisms to ensure the election of a board of directors. Perhaps you'll have a postal ballot every 3 years with a slate of directors. Members of the general public have to vote for them. Perhaps you'll offer the first preference in shares to the trades union, which usually controls the industry. If the coal miners want to control the coal mines, which they have been trying to do for the last 20, 30, 40 years, well, now they can control the coal mines. You all have them if you want them. That basically is our approach. The public owns them already. Well, we'll just give them a piece of paper to make it certain in shares, which they can then sell, of course, in the post offices and so on. These are the two approaches which we're going to introduce with the aim of convincing the Conservative Party in Britain that there are still solutions to these problems if one approaches this in a Gnostic light. And that is the purely mechanistic and functional approach. Here is a problem, let us solve it. It's the Gordian knot approach to politics. You can't unravel it, so cut the damn thing in half and get rid of it. And the reason I've been invited to address these very few and very brief remarks to you tonight is, I believe, in order to inspire you to take a similar approach to the regulatory agencies in America. That is, don't regard anything as intractable. There is always a solution somewhere, even if it takes a damn big knife and two big hands and a determined swipe at it. Go for the politically acceptable approach. The advantage of those two schemes in Britain is, first of all, the general public will probably accept them, but that's not terribly relevant. A major political party will accept them because it's in their interest to do so. And that is the way which perhaps you should be looking at the regulatory agencies in America. Now, some of them are going to be very easy to deal with. I think the Civil Aeronautics Board is an obvious one that's not very high in public esteem at the moment. One can see that by the way they're acting. They're weak, they're giving. They're letting the, what's it called, the cheap fares to Florida from New York, no-frills services. The fact that they let that through is an obvious sign of weakness. They know when they're under attack. Go for that one first. And the other one I would suggest you go after, for starters, is the Interstate Commerce Commission regulations on trucking. We live in times of inflation, right? We live in times of energy crisis, right? Well, you know, everything we send by road, everything we send in trucks costs more to send because these trucks have to take devious routes and they have to come back empty and they always have to take the long way around, and nothing must be allowed that could possibly lower prices or competition. And the effect is, of course, to keep prices up and to keep fuel and this vital energy, which we're also short of, keep the consumption of that up as well. Have a go at that next. The suggestion I'm making, in other words, is that a little bit of political realism goes a long way in dealing with things like this. Don't attempt to sweep the whole lot away at once. The Chinese have an excellent expression, the death of a thousand cups. Well, may I recommend to you tonight, and I would dearly love to see it happen, that the regulatory agencies in the United States should sustain that death. Let me enjoy it over several years. Just don't try to do it all at once with liberty amendments or things like that, because you'll generate all your opposition at once. Let's do it a bit at a time, savour it as it goes down, sip by sip. I look forward very much to seeing it.